Hi, I'm Brett Johnson, alcoholic.
Hi, Brett.
And I'm also a grateful member of Al-Anon. Thank you, Mike, for asking me to chair today. So I'm from Minneapolis, Minnesota. That's where I was born and raised, and I've lived around and done other things, but I'll tell you about maybe basically what it was like, what happened, and what it's like for me now, and kind of both perspectives. I grew up in a blue-collar, working-class town outside of Minneapolis, and my father was active alcoholic. My mother was crazy codependent, as I saw it. I had an older sister, and the thing that I knew in our family is that we're four individuals living in a house. There was no familial thing happening, and I knew that at a very young age, who I was basically irrelevant. The sum of my attributes is what was important, so if I brought certain things to the table, that's what was valuable, but who Brett was just didn't matter. I knew that I felt I was not safe in that environment. I couldn't trust the people that I was living with or that were raising me. And I became real reliant on self real early. Everything for me was, if I need to get it done, I have to do it. Or if it's going to get done, I have to do it. I have to take care of myself. I have to protect myself. All of those things. I lived in a kind of a heightened state of anxiety all through my childhood. And there's a couple things that I just wanted to clarify real quick. From the beginning, I knew that I've always felt that or experienced that there's a power greater than myself in some capacity. But to me, I never respected it like, but for the grace of God, there go I. For me, it was, oh, there's consciousness after my physical body expires, just like the sky is blue. To me, it's irrelevant to me as a person. It just is what it is. And I was aware of that. But on the other hand, I also knew that I had this really, I didn't have the words for this when I was a little kid, but with music, for me, music was something that I could escape into and felt peace and serenity when I was in it somehow, if that makes any sense. So those things were, that's what kind of my life was like as a kid. I knew about this higher power thing. My family was a bunch of individuals and felt crazy. And I knew that I could do music thing to feel better and kind of find some sort of sanity in my life. I remember that specifically there was, I guess kind of a good example of this was growing up, it was always important to my mother that I was, you know, courteous to my friends' parents or that I did well in school. And the message was really interesting as I look back on it as a little kid, because to me the message was, I'm supposed to do these things of how it's going to favorably reflect upon you, not because it's something I should actually do because this makes me a good person. Or this is a respectful way to be. So again, it's more of that, the attributes that I present is what's important. It's not about who I am, because ultimately it's all about you at the end of the day. So that was life for me growing up. My dad bowled, he golfed, he played softball, he drank beer, he worked a lot, and that was his life. We didn't have much of a connection. I didn't have the idyllic father-son relationship that I don't know anyone who actually had that, but I know that there was things that I wanted from a relationship with my father that weren't there. And it was just sort of, you know, again, it is what it is, or it was what it was. When I got to be 10 or 11 years old, my parents split, largely due to my dad's drinking. And my mother went into a depression and locked herself in a room for a couple years. And I started to feel, I went from a kid to an adult in about an hour and a half. I was playing marbles and army guys. Now I'm doing the laundry, making sure I have food, making sure I have rides, making sure I'm doing my homework, making sure everything. I'm now the parent in my relationship with myself. And at age 11, that was really overwhelming for me. I felt emotionally overwhelmed a lot. And I was, again, a thinker. I thought all the time because I had to rely on myself to get things done. So I had to learn how to figure my way out of things, how am I going to fix this? How am I going to solve this? How am I going to make these things work? Being that, I guess, cerebral at that age, knowing that I'm not going to be a free human being for another 8 years until I can go out into the world and be the adult Brett, that was also very depressing. And it got to a point where I was considering suicide in fifth grade. But the thing for me was, and I'm really grateful for this. Again, I'm grateful for that understanding that I believe there was a consciousness after death from a very young age, because to me, consciousness is thinking. And even if I killed myself, I'd still be thinking about this stuff for eternity. And that was not going to work for me. So I decided, hey, here's how Brett's going to figure out some coping skills. And obviously, I didn't have the words for that even when I was 11. But it's basically what I did. I figured out how I'm going to make this work until I'm an adult and can be free. So I'll go along to get along and make everything work. I hear people talk about being chameleons, and I felt, for me, I feel like I was doing that, but I don't think I was actually being fraudulent. I had attributes A through G, and you wanted to see A, B, and D, so I'd show you that, and that was sincere. But I didn't show you the rest of me. And then the other group, I'd show the other letters, and the other group, the other letters. So I had friends in all different groups, and I was liked in all those different groups, but if I showed any one of you all of me, you'd walk away. And so I was very protective of myself, which, funny, I read in Allen on Conference Proof Literature that that's actually a good thing, to be kind of safe about what you're sharing with, who you can share what with, and trust who you can trust and do those things. But I didn't know that then. However, that at the time turned into be this character defect for me as well. My dad drank. He drank a lot. I knew he did. That's why my parents split. So at 14, I decided to go figure that out. I don't know if this is actually true or not, but this is really what I remember. Because I remember the lie I'm telling myself is I want to go understand why my dad drinks. Why does he like this? So I'm going to go get drunk with three friends of mine and see what happens. So I did. And I got drunk. I threw up. And there was no aha moment. It wasn't the greatest thing in my life. I didn't want to wake up and do it again. There was none of that happened for me. So I was like, I don't get it. I continued on through life. Ultimately, graduated high school and moved on. I was getting to a point of, there was a key moment that happened there. When I was 17, a friend of mine showed up. We went to a concert, and he had acid. Drugs are a part of my story. And when I took acid, that was it for me. That was the aha moment for me. My mother got out of her depression, found Al-Anon, tried to take me to Alateen. And Alateen for me at the time in the 80s was like, you're another clique in high school I don't want to deal with. Like, I'm showing you attributes, that's all you want to see. There's nothing real or sincere going on because I'm not being real or sincere with you. Of course, I don't believe I had that understanding then, but that's how I experienced it. Al-Anon didn't take. My mother was a chemical dependency nurse for a hospital. And so now here she finds out, you know, Brett's doing drugs. Brett's drinking. Brett smokes weed every now and again. He's tried cocaine. He's done. And I'll say that too, that as a result, prior to even having that first drunk, you know, I hear about how recovery ruins people's drinking for them when they try to go back out. And for me, it was ruined before I ever started, because I had this seed planted that since your dad's an alcoholic and your grandpa's an alcoholic on both sides of the family, the odds are you're going to be an alcoholic. So there's all this fear and energy around that. So my mother decides that I need to go to treatment. So I go to treatment at 17, outpatient treatment. And I get out, and I'm the most gung-ho sober 17-year-old I could imagine. I stayed dry for a year and a half. They told me to go to AA. They told me to get a sponsor. And so I'm like, okay. So here, I like hallucinogenics, and now I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous, listening to 50-year-olds talk about drinking fifths of whiskey to get out of bed before they go to their construction jobs. I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And then go find a sponsor. And so I asked some people, hey, would you be my sponsor? Sure. And then we tried that, but I never hear anything again. So I white-knuckled it, as just a unself-will, because self-will is how I've done everything in life, and stayed sober for about a year and a half, or dry. And then magically this voice showed up and said, you know, it's kind of okay if you go smoke weed again, or if you drink again, or do something. Oh, now's the time. Now it's good. And so then I start that cycle that goes on for the next 20 years. In my early 20s, I moved to Florida. I had a couple of geographics, and one was going to California to make music with people. I was a senior in high school. I was making music with some guy in St. Paul. He moved out west. And he said, yeah, you should come out here after you graduate, and we'll play music together. I'm like, cool. And to me, what I heard is, yeah, move out here. We'll take care of you. We'll give you a place to live. We'll get you a job. We'll get you, yeah. And so I get out there, find out that's not true. And now I'm sort of this punk rock homeless squatting kid in San Francisco for 6 weeks. And then I'm like, okay, tail between my legs, call my mom, ask for a bus ticket home. And came back to Minneapolis. Year later, I moved to Florida. And I was a bouncer at a club. And this was funny to me because I'd never been in a fight in my life. But now I'm a bouncer at a bar. And I have this magic John Hughes film moment with the ID checker girl. And her and I were just in love. It was magical. So she liked acid too. So her and I were taking acid once, and we decided, you know, we could really spend the rest of our lives together. And I'm like, yeah. And so we got married 6 weeks later on Halloween of 93 in this, under this dark tree around Lake Eola in the middle of Orlando. And it was, again, it was great. She had told me all these things about herself, that she had degrees in this and that she was like this world-traveled person. It was amazing. I knew nothing about her. She was manic, depressive, bipolar, wasn't taking any medications for anything, went to a semester of community college and dropped out, it turned out, and all these crazy things were happening. And we were very fertile. We were a very fertile couple. And we didn't practice any birth control. But what we knew is that if she would take acid when she was pregnant, she would have a miscarriage. And so that's what we did. Every time she'd get pregnant, we'd go take acid. And she would have a miscarriage, and we'd move on with our lives, or till the next time that would happen. This, to me, was all normal and sane. Like, everything I was doing, the geographical moves, the life I'm living, the relationship I'm in, all of this is normal and sane to me. Finally, I came home one day, and she had it was in the evening, we were ready to go to sleep. There was a bottle of sleeping pills next to the bed that were empty. She said she'd taken them all, and she's committing suicide. I'm like, well, I'm calling 911. No, don't. Well, okay. We talked about it for a minute, and she just explained to me why she needed to die. And the funny thing for me is, this is how sick I was then, is that the only way I was going to get out of this relationship is if one of us died. And so I'm going to take the 50-50 chance that you're going to not make it through the night, and said okay, and see what happens. Of course she woke up. I was like, now I have to deal with this. And so I left that relationship and came back to Minnesota. But that was a real first example of how nuts I was and how normal this all really felt. My relationships continued like that through my 20s. Being a musician, I'm a musician. I started playing music as a kid and was in bands and worked and did all that stuff. Started drinking a lot with bandmates. After band practice, we'd go to the pub and we'd drink a few nights a week after we'd get done, or at a show, we'd drink, and drinking started to become more of a thing I was doing on a regular basis. My dad and I still had this tumultuous sort of relationship. He said some really hateful things to me in my mid-20s, like, I can't believe what a tremendous disappointment you've turned out to be, and if you're dying of a disease, I'm not going to come visit you in the hospital, and all these kinds of things. We just did not have a healthy relationship at all. And that's how life was kind of going. I'm still running the show, but I'm getting these glimmers of things that how bad things are happening, but they're working out in the best way possible, all things considered. And it's weirding me out. I'm like, why is that happening? Thank you. And to me, that was the real indicator that there's something going on that's beyond me. When I was 29 years old, I was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, stage 3 or 4. They didn't know. I'm basically dying of cancer before I'm 30 years old. Real slim chance. I have a terrible prognosis. I go through 6 months of chemo, and I'm in remission, magically. So I felt. And I was really grateful for that. And that experience really cracked the shell of my ego to where I could finally see that the illusion of the life that I was living. Like, something was just massively wrong, and I didn't understand it. Tried to find a lot of different self-help methodologies to figure out life. Again, it's me figuring out. I'm thinking my way through it. Finally, in 2003, I met a sober member of AA who, her and I became sort of inseparable, and we've started this wonderful relationship. I started to see how her friends and her community and the unity they had in their recovery, and I was super jealous of it. Again, I'm drinking 4 or 5 nights a week. I'm comparing my drinking to my friends. They drink way more than me, so I don't really have a problem. I can stop whenever I want to, but I can't stay stopped for some reason. I can stop for a while, but then I always go back. And that was sort of that cycle I was on. Somewhere in my early 30s, I lucked out and got into this sort of a band where I was able to play music professionally for a few years. And that became the Friday night gig you'd go play in your local town and go drinking after the show was now every night on tour. And that's what we just did. So every night is Friday, you know, getting wasted one day at a time. And living that life and experiencing it that way. Like, it's not that big of a deal. It's just, this is just what you do when you're on the road. This is how this works. Finally, in the middle of that, my girlfriend had to move to South Carolina with her kid so he could finish high school there, and that was great. I went down there to help her move and came back home to Minneapolis, and when I did, as soon as I got home, I cheated on her with this woman that she knew for a fact I was going to cheat on her with, and I was absolutely saying, there's no way this will ever happen. At that point, yes, I was drunk when that happened, and to me, alcohol did not seem to be the problem. When I woke up the next day, I was in this place of confusion and despair. I didn't understand why I was doing what I was doing. I didn't understand why I was living the way I was living, acting the way I was acting. Like, all of it was confusing to me. I didn't know what to do. So I called my mom and asked her what to do. I'm like, I don't know what to do. I'm finally at this, you know, place of willingness. What do I need to do? She said, go to Al-Anon. And I was like, what? And that didn't seem like a solution for me, but I was willing and found a meeting. It was a meeting where, and this was in 2007, June 2007, I went to my first Al-Anon meeting and heard, I was told that go to 6 meetings if you're going to go. And it doesn't have to be the same meeting, but go to 6 before you make a decision of whether or not Al-Anon works for you or not. The meeting I went to, I started to hear my story being told back to me by the people who were there. And I realized, wow, I might be in the right place. I knew sponsorship was important because of my girlfriend's recovery community and her AA. Sponsorship's a big deal in AA. So I'm like, well, I better get a sponsor. And there was just very few men in Al-Anon in Minnesota or Minneapolis at the time. And so one of the gals in my group, I asked her if she would be my sponsor. And she said, yes. I was like, great. And she said, the steps, it doesn't matter what order you work them in, and we can just kind of pick and jump around and do all this. And I'm like, perfect. And to me now, that makes my skin crawl and I freak out. But at the time, that's exactly what I needed to hear and what kept me coming back. As dysfunctional or not perfect as that meeting might be, it kept me coming back to Al-Anon. And I started to get into the literature and try to work the steps to the best of my ability. My dad died a couple years into that. He drank himself to death at the age of 64. And before that happened, because of the work that I did in Al-Anon, I was able to, at that point, I was able to find the forgiveness and the ability to help him in the last moments of his life, the last several months. I asked him to come in, move in with me. I know how to advocate in a medical situation because I went through cancer. So I know what questions I need to ask doctors, and I can do this on his behalf. And, you know, figuring out how to not take things personally and detach with love with him and everybody else. And was able to help him through to the last few moments of his life. Where we finally were able to have a conversation is that, you know, is there anything left unsaid? Is there anything we have to resolve that's still hanging out there? And we were both honestly able to say no, that there's nothing left. And to me, the fact that this man that I had this tumultuous, awful relationship my whole life, and now we're able to find this closure, and then he passed away, was a beautiful gift for me, and I think for him. But my drinking took off. After he died, all of a sudden I started drinking more, which to me was this odd thing. Ultimately, I ended up with a DUI. The DUI meant that I couldn't drive. So what did I do? I drank at home. So now drinking at home turns into a 12-pack and a bottle of Patron every night while I'm doing schoolwork and I work from home. And over the next 9 months, I'm finding myself in this sort of uncontrollable place with drinking. Long story short, on the 75th anniversary of AA, my girlfriend, who is a member of Minneapolis Intergroup and is speaking somewhere, asked me to come support her. And I went to this meeting, and I heard a 65-year-old woman talking from the podium, and she's now telling my AA story. And I was like, oh, my goodness. She talked about controlled drinking. Like, you know, if you don't think you're an alcoholic, go try controlled drinking. Next day I did. I went and decided to try some controlled drinking and see what happened. And I knew alcohol wasn't a solution for me anymore. I could drink and drink and drink. My brain was still crystal clear. My body was drunk, but it was just not happening anymore. So then I went to my first meeting of AA that next day, which was June 14, 2010. I already knew the drill of what needed to happen, watching my wife and she became my wife eventually, my girlfriend at the time and her friends do what they were doing. And got a sponsor who took me through the first 164 pages of the big book, went through the steps, got active in service, got a home group, got jobs in home groups, did all of these things. And just got to this place of peace and serenity with it, where I was able to understand what was happening. To me, it's tricky to talk about, but for AA, it's like I have this physical allergy of the body followed by an obsession of the mind, which defines my alcoholism. I put alcohol in my body, and this is what happens, the phenomenon of craving. I want to start drinking more, or if I stop, I can't stay stopped. That's that side of the 12-step recovery for me. For me, AA keeps me sober and helps me to do 12-step work to help reach other alcoholics or work with other alcoholics to keep them sober, help them get sober. And so I am of service in that way. I sponsor men in AA. I'm active in the fellowship. On the Al-Anon side, for me, I'm powerless over everything else. I'm powerless over people, places, and things, everything outside of myself. Sorry. And for me, figuring out how to take care of myself through the grace of a power greater than myself and taking the next right direction from my higher power and reaching out to those who are affected by the family disease of alcoholism, that's how I work the Al-Anon program, but I do the same thing. There's recovery, unity, and service on both sides, and it is not the same program depending on how you're working it. And when I go to Al-Anon, I don't talk AA. And when I go to AA, I don't talk Al-Anon, because to me, it's very different. Ultimately, the thing that I had the hardest time with was, frankly, in step three, turning my one life over to the care of God as I understand Him in either program. Ultimately, I was able to find a way to do that. But the thing that I struggled the most with was letting go of what my intent and will, or I'm sorry, the meaning and purpose of my life is. Like, I always felt, well, okay, I can let go of all these things, but what is my meaning and purpose? And ultimately, my higher power gave me this nudge. As that's to me how I take the next right direction, is my higher power gives me nudges. And the thing that it was almost like this voice. For me, it used to be, I'm driving the truck, God's riding shotgun. I'm like, hey, what's up? And he's telling me what to do. And I'm like, yeah, never mind. Now it's the other way around. God's driving, I'm riding shotgun. And I'm like, oh, okay, this is the direction we need to go in. Great. But the thing that he told me, however, that nudge was that if, you know, for me, when I'm running the show, it's like I'm in a rowboat paddling as hard as I can in one direction in the stormiest of seas. That's when I'm running it. When I've turned my will over, if my higher power is the ocean and I'm a bobber floating in it wherever my higher power wants to take me. And that's how I try to live my life every day. And I'll close with this. And to me, this is valuable for both programs. Each morning I wake up, I get on my knees, I say the third step prayer, I read the literature, I start my day by an action of gratitude and humility. I express my gratitude for being a spiritual being on a physical journey for one more day. And the fact that I get to do that is a gift enough. And I'll pass. Thank you.